And it is today's Topical Currents, Thursday edition. Joseph Cooper with you, along with Bonnie Berman. How are you, Bonnie?
Good afternoon.
Good to see you again. Well, the presidential debate is our first topic debate today. What was once conceived and monitored by the League of Women Voters is now formatted by the Commission on Presidential Debates. It's a private corporation created by Democrats and Republicans to structure the formats of national broadcasts. Joining us now is George Farah. He's the executive director of Open Debates. He's also written a book on the topic. And George Farah joins us now from New York City. Welcome to you, George. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So how do things differ today from those first and famous Kennedy-Nixon TV debates of, say, 1960?
Well, the first presidential debate was held in 1960, and then for three election cycles we had no debates because the candidates could get away with, at the time, just skipping a presidential debate challenge. But then the League of Women Voters took over the process. And from 1976 until 1984, the League of Women Voters ran our presidential debates. And they were a genuinely independent, nonpartisan organization that had the guts over and over and over again to resist the efforts by the Republican and Democratic campaigns to manipulate our debates, to exclude popular third-party voices, to reduce spontaneity and unpredictability from the format, to limit the number of debates. So the League of Women Voters was our voice in the negotiating room. They were our champion of the public interest. And it's for that reason that the Republican Democratic parties created a private corporation you just described, the Commission on Presidential Debates. So today, the debates that we see, by and large, are much more controlled behind closed doors and behind the scenes by the Republican and Democratic nominees than ever before. For example, all of the moderators that you're seeing have been vetted by the Republican and Democratic campaigns. They signed off on them. Some of the rules that they've included in their various contracts that govern the debates are designed to eliminate some of the actual unpredictability. For example, all the questions that we saw in the town hall debate had to be written by the town hall audience in advance and given to the moderator, who then pre-screened the questions and threw out the ones he or she didn't like. So generally speaking, you have a much more candidate-controlled forum now than you did, say, 20 years ago when an independent organization hosted these events.
Can I go back and ask you why the presidential debates were wrested away from the League of Women Voters in the first place?
Absolutely. You know, it's because the League had the guts to challenge the Republican Democratic candidates. And there's some wonderful examples. In 1980, independent candidate John B. Anderson, a former Republican congressman, bolted his party and decided to run as an independent for the presidency. He had about 12% in the polls, and somewhere over 80% of the public wanted him included in the presidential debate. But then-President Jimmy Carter vociferously refused to debate John Anderson, and the League was faced with a vexing question. Do they concede to the President of the United States, or do they push for Anderson's inclusion? Well, the League did the right thing. It listened to the aspirations of the American people and demanded that John B. Anderson be included. President Jimmy Carter refused to show up, and they left an empty chair on stage to signifying his refusal to participate. That, of course, enraged some of the members of the Democratic Party. 4 years later, you had the Walter Mondale and Ronald Reagan campaigns, the Republican and Democratic nominees. They vetoed 80 of the moderators that the League had proposed moderate the presidential debates. 80, one by
80.
One. The League didn't just take this sitting down. They held a press conference and attacked the candidates for trying to get rid of difficult questions. There was such a big public outcry that the candidates were forced to accept the League's moderators for the next debate. And finally, in 1988, the Republican and Democratic campaigns got together behind closed doors and draft the first ever secret contract, a 12-page document that dictated how the debate would be structured, who would be in the audience, all sorts of specific components of the debates. This infuriated the League of Women Voters. When they were asked to implement it, they refused. They made the document public, and they held a press conference saying, "We will not, quote, perpetrate a fraud on the American people or be an accessory to the hoodwinking of the American people." So the League was a force to be reckoned with, and they were willing to marshal public support to criticize the candidates when they tried to undermine the Democratic components of the debates. And it's for that reason that the two parties ratified an agreement in 1986 to, quote, take over the presidential debates and created this private corporation, this artifice of a commission, and now cedes much control to the Republican and Democratic nominees.
Why do you think the public, for the most part, is unaware of all this?
Well, part of it is the term commission, I mean, I think there's several reasons. You know, it's called the Commission on Presidential Debates. I can't tell you how many journalists that I've talked to over the last 8 years are working on this kind of project that just assume it's a federal agency. So the name in of itself gives you the impression that it's some sort of branch of the federal government or some neutral commission. Of course, it's not. Second of all, the commission survives on secrecy. It survives on the lack of transparency. If the American people knew on a day-to-day basis that the Republican and Democratic parties were meeting behind closed doors and having a kind of deliberations about whether or not to include a Ross Perot, for example, in the presidential debate, whether or not to allow moderators to ask follow-up questions, and were making these anti-democratic decisions behind closed doors, they would be held accountable for them. They, you know, if in 1996 Bob Dole had to look the American people in the eye and say, you know what, I'm sorry, we're going to keep out Ross Perot from the debates, even though three-quarters of the public want to see him, and even though he has $29 million in taxpayer funds, I'm sorry, I don't want him there, he would have looked like a coward and would have lost in the polls. So the commission gives the gift of secrecy to the candidates. They're allowed to do things to the debates behind closed doors that they wouldn't be able to do in public. And in order for that to happen, the commission has to persuade journalists, the general public, policymakers, that they're a genuinely nonpartisan organization. So they're engaged in a very effective propaganda machine to do that. And lastly, of course, a lot of people in positions of power, members of Congress, members of the Federal Election Commission, are comprised predominantly of Republicans and Democrats who have a partisan and political interest in maintaining the status quo. And so they're less likely to conduct an investigation. In 1996, the top lawyer for the Federal Election Commission actually recommended a widespread investigation of the Commission on Presidential Debates after the outrage of 1996. There was a fascinating story there. And it was vetoed unanimously by the six members of the Federal Election Commission because they're comprised of three Republicans and three Democrats that are picked by the president and ratified by the Senate.
We're speaking with George Farah, the executive director of Open Debates. George Farah, tell me, who pays the cost of the debates?
Oh, it's fascinating. You know, I just came back from I was at the debate Tuesday night doing some media in Long Island in Hofstra University. And the first place everyone goes to right after all the reporters and all the journalists and campaign staff, right after the debate's over, and the spin room where all the people go there to say who won the debate kind of dies down, they all head over to the absolutely wonderful Anheuser-Busch tent where the beer is flowing and staff members are passing out pamphlets denouncing beer taxes. Anheuser-Busch has been the principal funder of the Commission on Presidential Debates since its inception in 1988. They have given more than $550,000 in every election cycle since 1996. They've given millions of dollars, and if you see the debates themselves, there's posters everywhere. I have a little mug, a wonderful memento from the debate. It says, Debate 2012, Pride, Politics, and Policy, and then the other side says, Anheuser-Busch, Great Beer. So it's large corporations with regulatory interests before Washington are largely paying for our debates. In addition, Anheuser-Busch, Southwest Airlines, the International Bottled Water Association. You also have a couple law firms and a couple foundations. The commission has tried to diversify its funding sources in light of the constant critique. But these businesses are getting a really nice benefit from doing this. They get to simultaneously show support for both parties, Republicans and Democrats, and have their executives rub shoulders with candidates and their campaign staff, actually attend the debates. They get tickets, and they get a tax deduction to boot. So it's one of the many ways that corporations can flood money into our political process.
We're speaking with George Farah. He's the executive director of Open Debates. If you'd like to join in this conversation, any questions about the presidential debates, the way it is being done, the way it maybe should be done, please call us at 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN, or you can email radio@WLRN.org. That's radio@WLRN.org. George, you may know this. I didn't. When I was preparing for the show, I came across something on the Huffington Post that just hours after the debate at Hofstra, Democracy Now! Hosted a live two-hour debate between the three additional presidential candidates. Did you know that?
Yeah, actually, I did.
Oh, okay.
I was actually on Democracy Now! Earlier that morning. What was really interesting is that Jill Stein, the Green Party presidential candidate, actually got arrested for protesting and trying to get into the debate hall and was handcuffed to a chair for 8 hours until the debate was over. Oh. I was actually trying to get to the media center, and because of the hubbub, it was very difficult for the buses to go through in Secret Service. You know, it's The similar thing happened in 2000. Ralph Nader was running for president. 64% of the public wanted to see him. He got a ticket to watch the debate in an adjacent debate hall. That's it. He wasn't threatening to come and somehow crawl onto the stage and get past Secret Service. He was arrested and kicked out of the entire campus. Ultimately, the commission had to, as a result of a lawsuit, apologize to him and give him a $25,000 contribution to a democracy organization. It's just an ugly reflection of the intentions of the commission. You know, the commission every 4 years says hundreds of candidates run for president, hundreds of them. And they're right. You know, you've got Billy Joe Clegg of the Clegg Won't Pull Your Leg Party and Rob Crustacean of the Crustacean Liberation Party that wants, you know, crustaceans and crabs and lobsters to colonize the moon. There are some crazies out there who are running for president.
Yeah, but where do you draw the line? You know, we have to do this on this program, too. Sometimes people are running for governor, and where do you draw the line of someone who's a credible candidate and who isn't?
I think it's a very important question, and the position that I take and our organization takes is really try to maximize the democratic component of it. You know, the commission's propaganda on how many candidates run, it really is propaganda, because first of all, if you have the most liberal criteria in the world, which I don't advocate, but the most liberal criteria that says let's include everyone in the presidential debate that actually has a mathematical chance of winning the presidency by virtue of actually obtaining ballot access in enough states. This election cycle, including Romney and Obama, we would only have had 5 candidates on stage. That's not a zoo. You know, we had 7, 8, and 9 during the Republican primaries. 5 is not insane. So the idea that 400 are running for president really is a distraction. But we advocate for criteria that says if you're going to use polls, and this is what the commission does, the commission says a candidate, in order to get into the debates, has to have 15% in pre-debate polls. If you apply the commission's criteria, every third-party candidate in the last 100 years would have been excluded, including Ross Perot in 1999 and 1992, and John B. Anderson in 1980. So it really is designed to exclude the voices, and Jesse Ventura, for that matter, in Minnesota when he ran as a third party and became governor of Minnesota. We advocate a very simple criteria. If you're going to use polls to decide who gets to be in the presidential debate, why don't you just leave the decision to the American people and say, hey, who do you want to see in these presidential debates who's on enough state ballots to actually have a mathematical chance? And the American people have shown time and again they've been quite discriminating. If you use that criteria, only 4 third-party candidates in history make it. John Anderson in 1980, Ross Perot in 92 and 96, and Pat Buchanan and Ralph Nader in 2000. In other words, people who have demonstrated over and over again a civic commitment and the right, I think, to participate in these debates.
We're speaking with George Farah about the Commission on Presidential Debates. He's the executive director of Open Debates, which we'd like to discuss when we come back, but we need to take a short break on Topical Currents. Please stay with us, and we'll be right back. And welcome back to today's Topical Currents, Thursday's edition. Thanks so much for joining us. Bonnie Berman here with Joseph Cooper. We're speaking with George Farah, the executive director of Open Debates. And we're talking about the presidential debates and the Commission on Presidential Debates that has been now formatting these debates. George, tell us about Open Debates and how it came about.
Open Debates was formed in 2004. It's a small nonprofit organization that is designed to advocate for improving and reforming our presidential debate process. It doesn't support or oppose the inclusion of any candidates. We're genuinely nonpartisan. We just want the debates to more accurately reflect the aspirations of the American people. The website is opendebates.org. And we've actually, you know, it's been a wonderful year because we've seen some of the things we called for 8 years ago come true. First, the formats this year really have been, in many ways, very exciting. You know, when we first participated in this project, the candidates basically had about 90 seconds to answer a question. They were prohibited from talking to each other. And so there really was an exchange of memorized sound bites. But now, the debates this election cycle have been really exciting with tremendous fireworks, in large part because the formats have been redesigned because of the criticism of the commission that we've essentially spearheaded and pushed for a substantial discussion time between the candidates. So we're actually seeing the debate. So that's been exciting. And we also managed to convince 3 of the corporate sponsors that subsidize the Commission on Presidential Debates to withdraw their sponsorship because it's too partisan an organization, which we've never been able to do before.
Oh.
So we're pushing for our debates to be better, to have a sponsor that follows in the footsteps of the League of Women Voters and is more concerned with the loyalties of the American people than serving the interests of any political parties.
You referred to the commission. You're talking about the Citizens Debate Commission.
Yes, we created in 2004 something called the Citizens Debate Commission to rival the Commission on Presidential Debates. instead of, you know, two political operatives from the Republican and Democratic parties running it, our Citizens Debate Commission has 17 civic leaders from all over the political spectrum, from, you know, right-wing leaders and left-wing leaders and centrists. It was backed by 60 civic groups and 23 newspapers editorialized in support of it, replacing the Commission on Presidential Debates. But we failed to convince either major party candidate to participate in any debate hosted by the Citizens Debate Commission. This doesn't mean we should throw up our arms and give up. I think it was just planting the seeds of a long-term marathon where we will ultimately, I think, break the monopoly of the Commission on Presidential Debates and replace it with a truly nonpartisan entity.
Let's take a telephone call or two. We're speaking with George Farah. This is Dwight in Pembroke Pines. Hi.
Hey, guys. Bonnie. These recent presidential debates, in my opinion, have, you know, more structure to it, like Monday Night Wrestling, than it does an actual debate that I've ever attended in college. At the end of the day, you know, you just stand back and look. You know, there's literally billions of dollars on the table, you know, from each candidate. You know, it's, you know, from each of their supportive parties. I mean, nothing is going to change. They have no power to change it to begin with. Romney said, yeah, you know what, I'll accept that debate challenge from, you know, this other organization, this alternative organization. You know what? It just wouldn't go down like that. There's just too much, outside influence, and you couldn't even put your finger on it. You know, that's how much money and power is going in this. And just to that, that point with the billions of dollars, you know, have you ever seen such malaise in, like, the two choices that we have to make here, you know, with all this money being invested? I mean, you know, I really just find voting this time around to be just a chore, you know. And I'm only going to vote the way I'm going to vote because I don't see women and gays lose any more rights than they're already being beat over the head with in the first place. So, you know, I'm just voting on the social issues. Thanks.
Thanks, Dwight. George, any comment?
Yeah, there are two things that I thought you said were very fascinating. First, on the money issue, you know, this is part of the reason why we created this organization and fight so hard to try to make the debates better is because we perceive them to be our really only, I think, in the presidential election process, only real antidote to the influence of money over the elections. You know, if you don't have the debates in the primaries or in the general elections, basically voters are just subject, especially now that super PACs have been formed, to an onslaught of 30-second televised commercials that are manufactured by political consultants. They're overwhelmingly attack ads, and of course they're not an accurate representation of the positions of the candidates. It's really a lot of noise. And unless you have presidential debates that are really allowing real discussion to happen on air between the viable contenders for the presidency, we're not going to actually allow the voters to make choices based on real information or education. So we fight to protect the sanctity of these forums precisely because they're so important and are an antidote to the influence of money. The second point he made that I thought was really fascinating as well, you know, he said, you know, we're never going to be able to make this better because of the influence of money. I absolutely understand his point because it's really an uphill battle and it's a tough nut to crack. But once upon a time, we didn't have any debates. For three election cycles, the candidates could dodge them. That is no longer feasible. Any candidate today trying to avoid debates will get hammered in the polls, and the public will perceive him as being a coward. If we can raise our expectation level just another notch so that the public is disappointed if a candidate avoids not just a debate, but a real challenging and aggressive, nonpartisan, controlled debate, then we can start to win. So part of it is about raising the expectations of the public, which in turn put ultimate pressure on the candidates, and I think we're seeing that step by step.
Right.
George Farah, since this is such a big project for you, I wonder what would it have been like if you had been in the 1850s seeing the Lincoln-Douglas debates in Illinois.
Oh, that was amazing.
You could have been a fly on the wall, huh?
Yeah. Oh, I would love to have seen that. It's fascinating to see the difference because, you know, in 1858 we had what really are our first presidential debates. Seven debates between Abraham Lincoln and Stephen Douglas months before the actual election. Each candidate spoke for, I believe it was 90 minutes. Each debate lasted a total of 3 hours. And if you read the transcript, my God, the eloquence is unbelievable. Sometimes it's like reading poetry. And there was an extraordinary amount of civility between the candidates. They took very aggressive positions and disagreed with each other, but there was a mutual respect and a feeling that they knew at the time they were breaking history, that they were doing something groundbreaking by having these kind of conversations around the country. I miss those days. You can't imagine having a candidate talk straight for 90 minutes without sounding like Fidel Castro. But it is an exciting model to see where we've come from and what we are no longer acting like.
Let's take another caller. This is Miami caller, Mr. Jackson. Hi there.
Hi, it's Dr. Jackson calling from Miami. I'm one of the three authors of a book called The Presidential Debates, published in 1978 and went into paperback in 1980, and wanted to applaud your guests for questioning how certain people are on the commission and how they may be indirectly or directly remunerated for their role in deciding or preventing public conversations about the candidates.
George Farah?
Thank you very much for your kind words, ma'am. One thing that what you're saying triggered a reminder of is the composition of the commission. It's exactly what you're talking about. The two individuals that co-chair this Commission on Presidential Debates, it's really startling when I tell people who they are. It's Frank Fahrenkopf. He's the former chairman of the Republican Party and now the nation's leading gambling lobbyist. He's the president of the American Gaming Association. And Mike McCurry, the former press secretary to Bill Clinton and who has lobbied extensively on behalf of the telecommunications industry over the last 4 years. So you have two guys that are running our critical, most important election events that are obviously political operatives with deep loyalties to the two parties that have demonstrated through their occupations a willingness repeatedly to subjugate the interests of the American people for private or political interests. These guys do not hesitate to make decisions that they think are serving private and smaller interests at the expense of the American people in the democratic process. It's really not appropriate to shift from the League of Women Voters that really fought for our interests to these two gentlemen who have loyalties that lie elsewhere.
George Farah, tell me, what percent of voters would you guess are actually influenced by the presidential debates?
You know, it's a fascinating question. It's a hotly contested issue. Every 4 years, there's always articles written out there saying, do the debates really matter? And actually, I find those articles to be a bit inaccurate. I mean, they'll take a look at polls, and they'll say, wait a minute, no actual candidate seems to have won as a result of a debate performance. That's true, but that's often the case because there were such extraordinary leads. I mean, if you're going to look at some specific election campaigns where the candidates are winning by 20 points in the polls, sure, debates unlikely to shift the election. But they've played an absolutely critical role in our political process. They were decisive in 1960. They were decisive even as recently as 2000. You know, Al Gore and George W. Bush had a three series of very, very important debates in 2000. Bush was losing prior to the presidential debates by about 3 points in the polls. And Al Gore came into the debates with great expectations on his shoulders. The pre-debate spin was very effective in saying that, hey, George Bush is a terrible debater. If he manages to complete a sentence on stage, it'll be a victory. And everyone described Al Gore as being the greatest debater since Socrates, so anything he did looked like a disappointment. And because Al Gore was sighing and mentioned the word lockbox so many times, it drove viewers crazy, he lost the election. So I think it's fair to say as recently as 2000, the debates played a decisive role. And in this election, we're seeing the absolute enormity of the presidential debates. And it was almost a foregone conclusion that Obama was going to win this election until Romney put out a thunderous performance in the first presidential debate. So these debates are decisive, and I think they play a very, very important role in shifting the undecided voters on the eve of the election.
So we just have about 45 seconds left, but I just wanted to ask you what we, the public, can do to rectify this situation.
Please visit our website, opendebates.org, and join our little action alert list. This is a grassroots movement, and the candidates are our employees. They're running for our office. We have power, and if we demand they participate, and if enough of us push them to participate in real debates, they will have to do so, otherwise they suffer in the polls. So collectively we can do this, and thank you both for having me on your show.
Well, thank you very much. George Farah is the executive director of Open Debates, and the website again?
opendebates.org.
Okay, thank you so much for joining us. Food and Dining is next.
And we return. It is today's Topical Currents Thursday edition. Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman. Thursday's finally arrived, Bonnie.
Yes.
It's food and dining, of course. Our favorite time. Joining us now is chef, author, syndicated columnist, my good friend and colleague for many years, Linda Gastenheimer. And what a parade of desserts we had before us, Linda. I know that's your favorite.
It's my happy day.
You've been trying to keep that plate away from me. But
for sure.
It's,
I saw
it's like
you.
Trying to get a warm bone away from a dog or something.
Bonnie and Joe, hi.
Hello, Linda.
So tell me something. What's your favorite childhood dessert, one that makes your mouth water right now? Because I'm going to tell you mine.
Roasted marshmallows.
Oh, Bonnie.
Ice cream and cookies.
Oh, that's mine. Mine is ice cream topped with chocolate sauce, but it must come with chocolate chip cookies. I mean, that's a must, don't you think?
Yes.
Absolutely.
Yes, absolutely.
We're talking kid stuff, though, right?
This is adult stuff as far as I'm concerned. Well, our guest today's dessert memories turned her into one of America's top pastry chefs, Hetty Goldsmith, pastry chef extraordinaire.
Hi there.
Yep. Oh, she's here with us. And best, as we've already said, she brought us boxes of goodies.
Right. And I've no rolling pin, though.
Never mind. I'm eating these. So we'd love to hear from you, our listeners. What's your favorite dessert? Or do you have a question for Hetty Goldsmith? Give us a call. With your questions or suggestions, that's 800-743-9576, 800-743-WLRN.
And email, that's radio@WLRN.org.
Okay. Also with us, our favorite wine guy, Fred Tasker. You can read Fred's column in today's Miami Herald, and he's joining us today by telephone. Fred, what are we drinking?
Well, I thought we'd drink some dessert wines. That would seem to go with dessert. But I guess the question here for Joe is, is Linda sharing it all with you?
No.
I can't get it away from her.
I saw him take a cookie. I saw him.
I ate a cookie and she got on my case about it.
Boy, I thought that's what they were for.
Just a damn cookie, man.
Yeah.
Excuse me, watch your language, please. Hetty Goldsmith, first of all, congratulations on your book. I was drooling over every page. I mean, the pictures are eatable.
Thanks, Linda. And you're actually doing the happy dance. I see that, the sugar happy dance.
The sugar happy dance? Anytime with your sweets. Okay. You've brought your childhood treats. Now, you said this turned you into a pastry chef. How did that happen?
Oh, my love for sweets. My God, my mom never baked, and I had to rely on packaged goods. So I'm eating my way through chocolate chip cookies and eating my way through Nutter Butters. I realized that I wanted to make something that really tasted real and tasted with and was made with good ingredients. So that's what I'm all about.
I understand you had a little bake oven when you were little.
I had an easy bake oven. I absolutely did. I was 6 years old when I made brownies. Amazing what you can do with those light bulbs.
I didn't think you could bake with those. Anyway, but what you've done is you've taken these childhood sweets, but you've updated them. So tell us a little bit about that.
Well, like I was mentioning, I use really good ingredients, ingredients that you can actually pronounce, which is really very important. And I've also added flavors like black pepper. I've added curry to certain flavors and basil. So it's not really a really timid kind of thing. It's kind of like a shout out. So that's how I'm reinventing these childhood treats.
You put some curry and some basil, but you also put a lot of salt. The salt with the sweet. That seems to be the thing these days.
I do use quite a bit of salt, but I use really good salt. I use kosher salt. I use Maldon salt. I think using good salt is fine. It brings out a lot of flavors that are kind of hiding in the dessert. The salt will really just make that come out and sing.
I've heard that using herbs in desserts is the hottest thing right now, too. How do you get away with that? How do you get basil to go with, chocolate or whatever?
Well, actually, I take fresh herbs and I steep them in dairy or, you know, in various things. And it really kind of comes out in that cream. And you just get that wonderful, fresh herbaceousness when you eat, let's say, for instance, the basil panna cotta, which is in the book, One bite and it just it sings of summer.
Mm, but you brought, sorry, did you?
No, go ahead.
No, I just can't resist these peanut butter fudge brownies.
That's what I was going to ask about.
We're two minds alike.
Yes. What kind of peanut butter do you use?
I love using organic peanut butter. I think that has the most flavor, and it doesn't have that much salt, and it doesn't have that much of anything else but just pure peanut flavor.
Right.
So
right.
I say go for organic if you can.
And also, I noticed, because I was looking at it the other day, that the organic one does not have added sugar.
Right. Well, that's what I love about it, because you can regulate the amount of sugar you're putting in.
Right, and most peanut butters do. I didn't realize they had added sugar or corn syrup or something.
Everything. You know, yes. Yeah, it's just high-end sugar.
Right. You wouldn't believe this, but our board is full of phone calls when it comes to desserts. So let's go to Beth in Boca Raton. Hi, Beth. You're on the air.
Hi. First sign of spring in New York was the Charlotte Russe coming out on the bakery decks. It's still my favorite. Does anybody know?
Charlotte,
I guess you're all too young to remember what a Charlotte Russe is.
Charlotte.
We wouldn't admit it if we weren't.
I think Charlotte Russe has lady fingers around it. I'm not really
No, it's basically, I think, a sponge cake in a circle. And then it's got a huge mound of whipped cream on the top with some kind of ingredient flavoring in it that I don't know. And then a maraschino cherry. You just line them up, and they would be like little sentinels on the bakery shelf, and they would slide down, and you'd get one, and then another one was behind it, and it was like...
Well, I think what
incredible.
It is, I think it's made with some sort of berries, usually because it was spring. So I can't remember what, I think it was probably strawberries.
Right.
And it's in Europe, they use that a lot, and it had a lot of gelatin in it to hold it together. So it was kind of a mousse with gelatin in it.
Yes.
But thanks for your call, Beth.
Hi.
Thank you. We go to line one. Anne in Miramar. Hi, Anne. You're on the air. Hello, Anne.
Hi. I love dessert. But I had a question. When you're making a cake and it's a 13x9, can you put it in a bundt pan or vice versa? Does it matter?
That's a good question, because you never know. You have to go out and buy a certain pan for each recipe.
Well, basically, my thoughts on that is you can really use any pan that you have. You just have to adjust the temperature and the time. So if you have less product in it, if it's a larger pan, you would bake it for less amount of time at a bit of a higher temperature so it doesn't dry the cake out. So you have to kind of play with that, but you can interchange them.
Does that help you, Anne?
Okay. Yes. Yeah, I always undercook my cakes because I like them gooey.
Gooey. Well, yeah. Okay. Well, thank you for your call.
Thank you.
Talk about gooey. We mentioned these cookies that Joe ate when he shouldn't have. It was called Junk in the Trunk. Cookie.
It was good, too.
And it's gooey, salty, and amazing. So what's in it?
Oh, it's everything. It's whatever you have left in your pantry. Potato chips, pretzels, malty balls. It's great after Halloween when your kids have a lot of like extra candies like lying around. Just throw it all into this really delicious cookie base. Put a big chocolate chunk in there, and it's junk in the trunk. It's salty yumminess.
Yumminess, that's a good word. I love it. That's terrific. Okay, now you're going to be involved in a couple of events coming up very soon.
Yes.
One is called Alex's Lemonade.
Alex's Lemonade Stand Foundation, yes. November 1st at the Marlins Stadium. I'm very excited. It's actually
going... You're going to fill the whole stadium with cookies? I'll be there.
No, it's on the sweet level. It's sweet in sweets.
Okay.
It's basically... It will be based on all of the chapters of my book. So if you come, it's a dessert party, a huge, fun, crazy dessert party, and it all benefits Alex's Lemonade Stand Foundation, which raises money for research for childhood cancer.
Very, very worthwhile
absolutely.
Event. And I think they can find out more about it. I think it's alexslemonade.org.
Yes, I believe so, yes.
It's Alex's Lemonade Stand. Alex's has apostrophe S after
yes,
the X.
Yes, alexslemonadestand.org.
No, is it Lemonade Stand or Lemonade? Well, anyway, if they Google it, they'll find it.
Yeah, absolutely, yes.
Right. Okay, terrific. And another event that people can come and see you is going to be the Miami Book Fair International. I can't believe it's coming up soon.
I know, it's unbelievable. I'm thrilled to be part of it.
Right, and that's going to be on November 17th, Saturday at 3:30. You're going to be there at the book fair.
Yes.
So that's very exciting. But let's get back to the candies and the desserts and the okay. sweets and everything else. So I have to, you know my favorite. My favorite is your popcorn gelato. And I understood that you have an ice cream chapter that it was the belle of the famous Burger Bash. Tell us about it.
Oh, that's funny. Actually, Michael and I, Michael Schwartz from Michael's Genuine Food and Drink.
Which is, by the way, where she is pastry chef.
Exactly. Michael participated in the Burger Bash, and our burgers, I think, at MGFD are perhaps the best burgers around.
That's MGFD, is Michael's Genuine
Food and Drink.
Good, okay.
And we needed a side dish, so I was the sweet side dish. So I did a buttered
Not
popcorn gelato, right? Well, actually,
you are
I could
a sweet
be.
Person,
I
yes.
am. I am a hot side dish, actually, Linda. in case you haven't checked, I did ice cream sandwiches with buttered popcorn gelato, sandwiched between peanut butter cookies. It was really amazing. So that was my sweet side, and I was voted the best sweet side.
No question about that.
Yes,
that's absolutely
the
my favorite.
Best side dish that was sweet.
Right. Okay, and I like your hints in the book. In the book, and we're going to talk more about that, but I'm being told we're going to a break now. I'm Linda Gassenheimer, and my guest is pastry chef Hedy Goldsmith. We'll take a short break, and we'll be back with more.
On WLRN.
And we're back. I'm Linda Gassenheimer, and we're talking with pastry chef extraordinaire Hedy Goldsmith.
Wow, I just had that Hungarian shortbread.
That was flattering.
Oh, my
Whoa,
God. With
wow.
those, I let him
intense.
Have Fred, I did let him have one. I gave it to him.
Oh, you did finally.
Yes. Yes. Well, I've already had that one, so it's okay.
Well, Joe, it's Hungarian. Does that have some paprika in it?
No, I don't think so. You have to ask the chef.
No, it doesn't.
No, it doesn't. Well, the chef is that we're talking about, Hedy Goldsmith, pastry chef at Michael's Genuine Food and Drink. You've seen her on the Cooking Channel's Unique Eats, and she's got this wonderful new book out called Baking Out Loud.
Bonnie Berman's getting into the goodies now.
Just go ahead and take a look at the photographs in this book because you just want to eat every page.
That's very sweet of you to say. I think the photos came out great.
They're beautiful photos. And we are eating every page because you brought these wonderful goodies for us. So we're going to go to dinner in minutes now. So we're going to have something else with our meal.
All
we
right.
had dessert first.
Always. Always eat dessert first.
Always. Okay. Today's dinner. It's spaghetti with clams and herb sauce. That's another sort of traditional, old-fashioned kind of dish.
Indeed.
Fresh tomatoes, scallions, basil, and tarragon. It gives an unexpected flavor to this traditional Italian dish. Well, of course, I make spaghettini, which is thin spaghetti, or you could use regular spaghetti. Boil that, the amount of time on the package. While that cooks, you can sauté some garlic, a little clam juice and wine, and then cover it so it simmers and all the flavors will get together. And then you add some clams, and you cover and simmer for maybe 5 minutes. Shake the pan every once in a while, and the clams will open. If they don't open, discard any that don't. You transfer the clams and sauce to a big bowl, and then add fresh tomatoes cut up in little cubes, some scallions, sprinkle with some basil and some tarragon. And Eddie's getting a big smile on your face.
It sounds great. Mm-hmm. I love savory food.
Okay. So then you drain the spaghettini, put it in big bowls, and spoon the sauce over it. Now, that complete recipe and photo is at dinnerinminutes.com. These people here are so busy eating the desserts, they haven't even tasted my spaghetti and clam. Come on. the photo, recipe, dinnerinminutes.com. And please follow me on Twitter, at L. Gassenheimer. Fred, I suppose we're drinking today?
Oh, you know, one of the nice things about wine is that there's one that will go with absolutely everything.
Okay.
First, fruit tarts and pies and flan and other moderately sweet desserts go well with late harvest wines, which are usually made from white grapes like Sauvignon Blanc, Semillon, and that sort of thing. And these are sweet because the grapes are left on the vines longer than regular. That's why they're called late harvest, and they build up more sugar, and these can be great. But I see that a lot of Hedy's desserts are chocolate. So the question becomes, is there a wine that goes with chocolate? And of course
she's,
there is.
She's nodding her head, Fred.
Yeah, it is port from Portugal. With port, red grapes are picked and put under fermentation, but then the fermentation is stopped while most of the sugar is left in the wine, keeping it very sweet. And the way they stop the fermentation is by adding grape brandy. So the wine is 17 to 20% alcohol. You have to be a little careful of that. But it's perfect with chocolate.
Well, my goodness, what a fabulous thing. You have 20% alcohol in chocolate, in Hedy's chocolate cakes.
Well, it sounds great.
And then you go to bed.
Yeah. Actually,
but, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, Fred, I was just going to say that I love serving bourbon. I'm a bourbon drinker. I love bourbon
really?
And chocolate desserts. So that's the route I like to go.
That's even a little stronger, huh?
Yeah, much stronger.
So
yeah,
would you wake up bourbon. With a headache?
Not at all, excuse
yeah,
me.
Yeah, but a well-deserved one. Well, by now, of course, you're asking, but Fred, what kind of beer goes with dessert, right? You were about to ask that, weren't you?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Actually, there are plenty. They're called fruit beers, and a lot of fruit beers come from Belgium, although Lindemans of Australia also makes them. And these are beers to which whole fruit or fruit syrup is added, and you can add almost anything, cherry, raspberry, peach, strawberry, even banana or pineapple. And fruit beers, maybe surprisingly, are often lower in alcohol than regular beer, as low as 2.5%. So if you don't want to have the bourbon, you can have the fruit beers. But this actually does vary wildly, and Dogfish Head Brewery in Delaware, which we talked about last week.
I was going to say, we had a strawberry beer last week.
Yeah, and they also make a big variety of fruit beers. Some of them are also low in alcohol, but they also have a raspberry beer that's 18% alcohol, so you better read the label. Anyway, while it might seem counterintuitive, a strawberry beer with a strawberry tart is a marvelous dessert.
Sounds good to me. Well, we left off last before the break about tips that Hedy gives you with each recipe in the book. It really helps you with your baking. The one that surprised me was that the lemon meringue tart, to get that meringue all golden, you say don't put it under the broiler.
No, not at all. I use a blowtorch for that.
Okay, go ahead, Bonnie.
Yeah, we have an email for Hedy. My name is Enoch. I just changed my eating habits to very low sweet and salt. Do you have any suggestions of some dessert of that nature? I like raisin cookies.
Raisin cookies are great. I
How
also
would
like
you make
shortbread.
Them without sugar and?
Well, he said low sweet and salt, so not.
Can you use Splenda instead of sugar in all cases when you're baking?
You really could. I'm just not sure exactly the ratio, but you certainly could.
Well, actually, when you're cooking like that, the thing that people don't realize is that when you put sugar, and I think Hedy probably will help me with this, the sugar, when it cooks, it gives off CO2 and it helps your cake rise. It lightens things.
The gas.
So if you're going to use Splenda, I think you need to maybe use half Splenda and half sugar, something like that, and you need to really test your recipes with that.
Yeah, maybe.
Because Splenda doesn't give off CO2.
Now, Splenda is not a sugar and it's not an alcohol, although it's called a sugar alcohol.
Right.
Okay.
It's a chemical thing.
I think it's going to be perhaps a heavier product.
Right. It'll be spongy or not the texture you're used to. Okay. So now, Hedy, your creations, and I have to call them creations because they aren't just desserts. They're work of art. So how do you come up with all your ideas?
Well, you know, I'm influenced by just about everything that I see. I'm influenced by mixologists that create these fabulous cocktails that layer flavors. So I'm constantly being aware of my surroundings and flavors that go together and flavors that may not be typically together. So really, I'm influenced by everything. I eat out a lot. I read quite a bit. So I try to keep up with the trends.
You were also an art major. So does that help you with your making them look beautiful?
Oh, absolutely. I think my art background really prepared me to be a great pastry chef in terms of, composition.
Right. Now, we have a plate of goodies here. And there's one that looks just amazing because it's got peanut butter in it. It's got like two cookies with peanut butter in the center. Is that what that is?
That's my overstuffed Nutters. Yeah.
Ooh. Overstuffed Nutters. What is it? We've got her. So she's so excited that she's. Excuse me. That's all right. Well,
I think I have a piece of nutter caught in my throat, actually.
You shouldn't be eating on air. Okay,
exactly.
Fine. All right. Well, you know what? We're out of time. It's been a really, really tasty week. Hedy Goldsmith, congratulations on your book. It's called Baking Out Loud.
Thanks so much.
And thank you for all the delicious goodies.
Indeed.
Yes. And yes. Bonnie Berman and Joseph Cooper, I let you eat well today.
Bonnie was even dunking the cookies.
Uh-oh.
Thank you.
Yes, I saw that. Fred, great advice as always.
Always a pleasure.
Right.
It was a
and Hedy, you'll be at Alex's Lemonade event November 1st at the Marlins Stadium?
Yes, I will.
Okay.
With all my sweets.
All the sweets for the sweets. She's going to fill the entire stadium with all these wonderful things.
So please join me and support a great, great cause.
It's an important cause. And also you're going to be at the book fair on November 17th. So that's great. Well, next week we're going to be talking with Cook Yourself Sexy author Candice Kumai. I'm Linda Gassenheimer. Join me then.
And thanks for listening this afternoon. Our program is produced by Richard Ive. Technical direction by Caroline Brader-Watts. Paul Leary gives production assistance. And follow us on the Topical Currents Facebook page. Many items to see there. And find free audio archives and MP3 downloads at our website, WLRN.org. Tomorrow at 1, it's Ed Bell and the South Florida Arts Beat. Monday, we return with veteran reporters Donald Bartlett and James Steele. They chronicle the erosion of the U.S. middle class in the book, The Betrayal of the American Dream. What went wrong? And today's calendar, on this day in 1926, 86 years ago, the birth of music legend Chuck Berry in St. Louis. While a junior in high school, he was convicted of armed robbery. He traveled to Chicago in 1955 and recorded Maybelline. And he was in the first class of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And, 86 years old, he'll be playing in Alton, Illinois this Saturday. You choose to go. And on this day in 1939, 73 years ago, the birth of Lee Harvey Oswald in New Orleans. He was murdered on live national TV 2 days after the assassination of President Kennedy. And his rifle can be viewed at the National Archives. Our theme music, created by Michael Levine. And on this day, 1972, 40 years ago, Congress passes the Clean Water Act over the veto of President Nixon. And we leave with Lee Oswald after his arrest for the shooting of Dallas policeman J.D. Tippit. Quote, "I don't know why you're treating me like this. The only thing I've done is carry a pistol into a movie." This is Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman and Linda Gassenheimer. Thanks for making public radio your companion today. Stay tuned now for the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.